Some years ago, a tablet magazine published a piece about a member of the administration of a religious Jewish school in my hometown of Chicago who had an unusual hobby. He collected autographed baseballs that were not first and foremost signed by baseball players. Rather, these balls contained the signatures of famous rabbis and Torah scholars. I believe the article was titled, A Rabbinic League of Their Own. Why, you might ask, would he do such a seemingly strange thing? The question occurred to the author of the article, Joseph Wheeler, as well, and he tells us, quote, how did Harris, associate principal of Ida Crown Jewish Academy, a modern Orthodox yeshiva in Chicago, come to have a collection of baseballs signed by religious all-stars? A lifelong baseball fan, Harris, 52, told me he'd been seeking the signatures of baseball greats for more than two decades. Over time, though, as Harris outgrew his childhood role models, he realized he had exchanged players of physical brilliance for legends of spiritual grandeur, and that those were the heroes he wanted to recognize. I would have never imagined that given the choice between a baseball signed by Babe Ruth or one signed by a great rabbinic leader, I would have chosen the rabbi, he told me. And yet, the article continues, that's exactly what is happening these days as he builds up a collection of baseballs autographed by his true heroes, the great rabbis or gedolim of our era, displaying them prominently on his desk at the school. Students come into the office and say, wow, when they see those names, when they see whose names are on the baseballs, he said. This opens up the conversation to who are our heroes and who they should be in the modern world, end quote. This unusual hobby, in other words, has a pedagogical potential. But is that, ladies and gentlemen, all that there is to it? Or can the baseballs themselves embody something about Judaism, about faith, about the teaching and transmission of the Torah, to which, the endeavor to which, those whose rabbinic autographs appear dedicated their lives? The article further tells us, quote, Daniel Harris's collection of autographed baseballs boasts signatures from the likes of Willie Mays and the 1969 Chicago Cubs, but the crown jewel bears an unusual message. Aharon Lichtenstein, who strives for stardom in another league, it reads, end quote. This, of course, is Rabbi Aharon Lichtenstein, one of the late great scholars of our generation, who signed the baseball with those words, which means that Rabbi Lichtenstein clearly knew what baseball was and was using it as a metaphor to compare it to Judaism, who aspires to stardom in another league. We are, you might say, not entirely unlike baseball, but we are in another league. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not, God forbid, comparing a pastime, a game, no matter how sublime, to Judaism, to the foundation of our identity. But the fact is, or at least I'm not equating them, even if I'm comparing them, but the fact is that long before this baseball collection got its start, the rabbinic sages themselves utilized a ball game as a metaphor for faith, for Torah, for Jewish continuity. Let us see how this is so. In Kohelet, in the book of Ecclesiastes, we find the following verse, Divrei Chachamim Kedor Vanot. The words of the sages are akin to goads. Goads are essentially biblical cattle prods. The words of the sages are akin to sticks. A simile that would seem to symbolize severity. In other words, the point is that at times sages, rabbis, if you will, need to be strict. But what's interesting is that the sages themselves in the Talmud ask us to homiletically reread this verse so that a seemingly opposite meaning is given. Divrei Chachamim, not kedor vanot, but rather kikadur banot, which means the words of the sages are like a ball game played by young children, banot, young girls. What exactly is the comparison here? The medieval commentator Tosafot explains that this refers to a game in ancient times where a ball was tossed from player to player, and the goal was not to drop it, not to drop the ball, to pass it on to the next participant. And here too, the words of the Torah, the teaching of the sages, the sound of Sinai itself is being compared to a ball game. The words of the Midrash are extraordinary, and it goes on to say as follows, Ma katur zeh, mekalin ba biyadayim ve'ena nofelet. just as the ball is tossed from hand to hand, passed between hand to hand. Kach Moshe Rabbeinu kipel misinayu misara liyoshua v'yoshua liskenim. So too was the Torah received by Moses at Sinai and passed to the next generation, and so on. In other words, the passing of a ball from hand to hand is compared to the very transmission of the Torah from generation to generation. The meaning of this midrashic statement, and here I draw on something I heard from my father, is that there are two ways to look at our heritage. On the one hand, reading the verse literally, we can say that Judaism, the tradition, is akin to sticks. The words of the sages, the transmission of the Torah, is in some way filled with rules and regulations that are not always easy to obey. And our identity, as Jews usually, is forced upon us. Most of us did not choose to be Jews. We were born into this tale of the Jewish people. So we can see this as something very strict in our lives, akin to staffs, to sticks, to rods. And yet there's another way of looking at it. What a ball game connotes is continuity, because of the way the ball is passed, but also because the game can be taken up as a pastime, as a national pastime, as a common endeavor, and therefore can be seen as something that marks the very passing of the ball or of the baton from generation to generation. Perhaps the most famous quote in movie history about baseball comes from James Earl Jones in the film Field of Dreams, where the character he plays is explaining to Kevin Costner's character why people from across America will somehow find their way to a magical baseball field in the middle of a farm in Iowa. And he gives the following justifiably famous description of baseball's significance to America. This is the clip.
The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball. America has rolled by like an army of steamrollers. It's been erased like a blackboard, rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked the time. This field, this game, is a part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good and it could be again. Oh, people will come, Ray. People will most definitely come.
Baseball in America has marked the passage of time, and it somehow links generations. Here too in the Midrash, when a ball game is being compared to the transmission of the Torah, what is being communicated is that in the transmission and in the reception of Judaism, we are part of something much larger than ourselves, and yet the previous generations are counting on us. And from this perspective, Judaism is not a rod or a staff or a stick. It is not strict. Rather, to accept the responsibility put upon ourselves is so incredibly meaningful because there are so many generations that have come before, expecting us to take the ball, not to drop the ball, and to pass it on. We are asked to continue the story. In discovering that we are part of this team, that we are part of something larger than ourselves, then we truly discover who we are. Judaism is, for all of us, a league of our own. If this is the case, then in this spirit for today's Faith and Film discussion, I will be focusing on a movie that is ostensibly about baseball, but is actually truly about familial connection, intergenerational bond. I will in fact suggest that one of the most beloved American films of all time can actually help us understand one of the most enigmatic tales in Tanakh of all time. We know that in Exodus, the divine descends on Sinai amidst powerful pyrotechnics, smoke, lightning, and fire. All of Israel assembled reacts in awe as the Torah was given, as the Decalogue was declared. If there was anyone who attempted to recreate this very same scene, the very same powerful pyrotechnics generations later, it was Elijah, Eliyahu Hanavi, who, as described in the Book of Kings, assembles Israel at Mount Carmel, and in order to turn them away from idolatry, summons down the divine fire before them. They too react in awe. But just as Israel at Sinai, 40 days later, embraced the golden calf, so too did Israel of Elijah's age return almost immediately to pagan pastimes. Elijah, enraged, flees the wicked King Ahab into the wilderness, and he returns to Sinai itself, to the mountain of God. There God restates, or if you will, reenacts the Sinai revelation, but with a twist. The pyrotechnical parade passes before Elijah, but God, we are told, was not there. Lo ba'ish Hashem, a fire went before Sinai, but God was not in the fire. An earthquake occurred, but God was lo barash, not in the noise. And then ultimately the Almighty makes himself known in a kol dimama daka, in a still, small sound. What is taking place here? What is God telling Elijah here? And what does the sound of the still voice connote? In analyzing and answering these questions, we turn to the Field of Dreams. A film that stars Kevin Costner as Roy Kinsella, who lives with his wife Annie on a farm in Iowa. He narrates the beginning and tells us the following. My father's name was John Kinsella. It's an Irish name. He was born in North Dakota in 1896 and never saw a big city until he came back from France in 1918. He settled in Chicago, where he quickly learned to live and die with the White Sox. Died a little when they lost the 1919 World Series. Died a lot the following summer when 8 members of the team were accused of throwing that series. He played in the minors for a year or two, but nothing ever came of it. Moved to Brooklyn in 35, married Mom in 38. He was already an old man working at the Naval Yards when I was born in 1952. My name's Ray Kinsella. Mom died when I was 3, and I suppose Dad did the best he could. Instead of Mother Goose, I was put to bed at night to stories of Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, and the great shoeless Joe Jackson. Dad was a Yankees fan then, so of course I rooted for Brooklyn. But in 58, the Dodgers moved away, so we had to find other things to fight about. We did. So the movie begins, about a difficult relationship between a father and a son. Both love baseball, but even baseball, at that moment, could not bond them. Throughout his childhood, Ray drifts apart from his father. Until when he was 17, Ray made a caustic comment about his father's favorite baseball player, shoeless Joe Jackson of the Chicago White Sox, who had been caught up in the World Series throwing scandal. As Ray says about his father in the film, he never made it as a ball player, so he tried to get his son to make it for him. By the time I was 10, playing baseball got to be like eating vegetables or taking out the garbage. So when I was 14, he says, I started to refuse. Can you believe that? An American boy refusing to have a catch with his father. And then he adds, anyway, when I was 17, we had a big fight. I packed my things, said something awful, and left. After a while, I wanted to come home, but I didn't know how. I made it back for the funeral. He died before I could even introduce him to Annie. Ray further tells us at the beginning of the film that I'm 36 years old, I love my family, I love baseball, and I'm about to become a farmer. And until I heard the voice, I'd never done a crazy thing in my whole life. The voice. The voice is the center of the film. And we see, after this narration, we see Ray all alone amidst the corn, farming, his wife and daughter back on the porch of his house. And suddenly he hears a voice, but it is not a loud voice. Rather, it is, in the words of the Bible, a still small voice, the sublime sound of an ethereal whisper that only he can hear. Let us see this clip.
Thank you. Danny, what was that?
What was what?
That voice just now, what was it?
We didn't hear anything.
All right. Okay, you must have heard that.
Sorry. Hey, come on in to dinner.
Let's go, Pumpkin.
If you build it, he will come. One of the greatest of movie mistakes is that many assume that the voice says to Ray, if you build it, they will come. This is absolutely incorrect. I was struck, actually, when I went back to YouTube to watch it. Somebody commented, having just rewatched it himself. What? It's not if you build it, they will come? But it's not. If you build it, he will come. This is important. Ray is not sure who is speaking to him, but he somehow intuits the meaning to be, this is his interpretation, that if he builds a baseball field in the middle of his corn, then his father's hometown hero, Shoeless Joe Jackson, will return to play and will experience from the afterlife a chance at redemption, a return to baseball. This is what he does, and after a long wait indeed, Shoeless Joe Jackson and other players from the past suddenly arrive from out of the cornfields, and they begin to play ball on the field. Let us pause in the midst of our summary for a bit of analysis of this film, of this plot, from a Jewish perspective. It is alone in Iowa, amidst the cornfield, that the voice is heard. Is that because the voice only called him till now? That is the simple understanding. But there is another. Perhaps that voice was always calling out to him, but it was only amidst the solitude, apart from the noise of civilization, that he was finally able to hear it. My teacher, Rabbi Norman Lamb of blessed memory, has a wonderful sermon which is titled Divine Silence or Human Static. There he quoted the statement of the sages, Bechol yom v'yom bat kol yotze mehar chorev. Every day, a divine voice goes forth from Sinai. In other words, God's voice that sounded at Sinai thousands of years ago actually never stopped speaking. And if we do not hear it, Rabbi Lamb said, if we do not hear the voice of God, it is not because it has stopped calling us, but rather because we have lost the ability to listen. What stops us from hearing, as he put it, is not the lack of divine voice, but the human static. We need to shut out the human noise in order to hear. The voice of God is always calling, but we have to be in a position to listen for it. This is perhaps what Winston Churchill remarkably meant when he wrote in an essay about Moses, why it was so important for the greatest prophet in Jewish history to flee into the desert from Pharaoh. Churchill wrote, every prophet has to come from civilization, but every prophet has to go into the wilderness. He must have a strong impression of a complex society and all that it has to give, and then he must serve periods of isolation and meditation. This is the process by which psychic dynamite is made. In this vein, Rabbi Sachs has suggested that the phrase in the Elijah story at Sinai, Kol Dimama Daka, usually read the still small voice, ought to be interpreted as a voice for which you must listen if it is to be heard. As he put it, quote, the desert is a place of silence. There is nothing visually to distract you, and there is no ambient noise to muffle sound. To be sure, when the Israelites received the Torah, there was thunder and lightning and the sound of a shofar. The earth felt as if it was shaking at its foundations, but in a later age, when the prophet Elijah stood at the same mountain after his confrontation with the prophets of Baal, he encountered God not in the whirlwind or the fire or the earthquake, but in the Kol Dimama Daka, the still small voice, literally, the sound of a slender silence. I define this, Rabbi Sachs continued, as the sound you can only hear if you are listening. And that is the point here as well. Just as in the desert, the sound of God could be heard, Ray, away from his own ambient noise, in the cornfield, in the field of dreams, Ray hears the voice that I think was calling out all this time, but he only hears it now. If you build it, he will come. But who is he? Ray assumes that this means Shoeless Joe. But only at the end of the film does Shoeless Joe himself, played by Ray Liotta, who you see in the picture behind me, as he's about to leave the field, look at Ray and say to, and he says to Ray, if you build it, he will come. And then, spoiler alert, the catcher that has been playing in the game the whole time takes off his mask. And Ray realizes that that is his father, John, John Kinsella, but not as the time-worn man that he knew growing up with whom he fought, but rather as the young minor league player full of dreams. Let us see this remarkable scene.
What? What are you grinning at, you ghost?
If you build it, he will come.
Oh, my God.
What? What is it?
It's my father. Ease his pain.
Go the distance.
It was you.
No, Ray. It was you.
I saw him years later when he was worn down by life. Look at him. He's got his whole life in front of him, and I'm not even a glint in his eye. What do I say to him?
Why don't you introduce him to his granddaughter?
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to thank you folks for putting up this field and letting us play here. I'm John Kinsella.
I'm Ray. My wife, Annie. This is my daughter, Karen. Karen, this is my... This is John.
Hi, John.
Hiya, Karen.
Well, we're gonna let you two talk. I mean, if all these people are gonna come, we got a lot of work to do. It's very nice meeting you. Come on up.
Thus does Ray finally understand what the voice meant. If you build it, he will come. He is his father. His father, not Shoeless Joe. But I think the central line in the movie appears at the heart of this scene, and it is often overlooked. After Ray sees his father, after Shoeless Joe Jackson says to Ray, if you build it, he will come, Kevin Costner Ray looks at Shoeless Joe and says, it was you, meaning it was you, Shoeless Joe, you were the voice who told me that if you build it, he will come. And as he departs the scene, Shoeless Joe replies, no, Ray, it was you. It was you. No, Ray, it was you. This is the central line of the movie, and its meaning is clear. The voice saying, if you build it, he will come, came from within Ray the whole time. It was a still, small voice that was always there. It was a manifestation of his desire to connect with his father. As you saw in the scene, Ray introduces his father to his family, to his granddaughter, and suddenly a joining of generations takes place. The generational link is reestablished. The voice had been within him the entire time. It was you. No, Ray, it was you. It's with this in mind that I would like to approach again the enigmatic passage in the book of Kings. God at Sinai appears to Elijah in a still small voice. As the commentator known as Malbim notes, Elijah had been attempting to frighten Israel into obedience by creating awe-inspiring experiences, bringing down veritable infernos from the Almighty. He was, in other words, attempting to recreate our ancestors' original experience at Sinai and to force them by fear into obedience. But instead, God is saying, you, Elijah, must help them find God in this still, small voice. As Malbim puts it, Ki Hashem yishalach et neviav sheyavo alehem bekol demama, for the Almighty sends his prophet in a small sound. What this means for Malbim is that not strictness but kindness is required. But I would suggest something slightly different. Elijah's original approach, terrifying fire from heaven, was a form of motivation, however wondrous, that did not work because it was external. He is coming in literal fulfillment of the verse in Ecclesiastes. The words of the sages are akin to goads, staffs, rods. He is almost trying to beat them into submission. And suddenly God is appearing in a small voice to tell Elijah that he must teach the Israelites to find that voice within themselves. For within each member of God's people is a voice, a yearning, a desire calling out to reconnect to the past, to the generations before, to receive their identity, the Torah, from a previous generation. Just as a ball is passed from father to son, or between child and child. We need to learn to hear this voice, in other words, not only from a prophet, but from within us. It is there. It was you. No, Ray, it was you. The voice is within us all calling out, but it relates ultimately not to baseball, but rather, as Rabbi Lichtenstein put it, to another league entirely. And it is here that there is something else interesting that I have learned, a bit of movie trivia that is theologically instructive. What actor gave us the actual voice of the voice? Who said, if you build it, he will come? If you watch the credits of Field of Dreams, no one specific is listed. The voice is just listed as himself. That's the name that's put, with a capital H. I believe it was the director of the film who said, quote, I thought that was sort of funny. It was okay with the person who did the voice, so we just decided to keep it a secret, end quote. This may have all been a joke, but it is, perhaps unintentionally, enormously profound because it provides us with a meaningful metaphor. The still small voice comes within us. It comes from us. But the ultimate source that it seeks is the great himself with a capital H. The sound of Sinai, as we said, still continues today. And we are made to hear it through our connection to those who have come before us. V'hodatam levanecha v'livnei vanecha, we are commanded in the Torah. You shall make known to your children and your children's children, yom asher amata lefnei Hashem Elokecha b'chorev, the day when you stood before Almighty at Sinai. The Midrash, as I've mentioned in our previous faith and film discussion about the Ten Commandments, famously recounts how when Moses first met the Almighty on Sinai, at the burning bush, God spoke to Moses in the voice of Moses' father. The voice, in other words, is within us, urging us to connect back to those who came before, those who, if you will, passed the ball to us. We all seek intergenerational connection. We all want to discover who we really are. And in this connection, we hear not only the voices of the past, we hear God. We hear He, the voice, capital H, Himself. The voice is from within us, but it connects us to so much beyond us. It was you. No, Ray, it was you. In the aforementioned sermon that Rabbi Lam gave, wherein he said that we do not hear the divine voice because of human static. Rabbi Lamb, speaking in 1962, bemoaned the noisiness of our age. This is what Rabbi Lamb said 60 years ago. Why do we not listen? Why do we not hear? Our problem is we are too busy talking. We are too involved in so many things that are inconsequential and meaningless. Our society is too wordy. We are drowned in the verbosity of our mass media of communication. Words come to us not in sentences but in veritable torrents from mouths and radios and TV and newspapers. Our mind and our senses are so battered with trivial and insignificant information, we do not know where to begin. Ladies and gentlemen, this was 1962. Just imagine the comparative distractions that we have today. We do indeed live in a noisy age. But though the small voice is more easily heard in the wilderness, Moses insists to the Israelites who are about to enter the land of Israel that lo bashamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven. Ki karov elecha hadavar me'od, it is very close to you. You can connect with the generations of Judaism here on earth. All we need to do is to try again, and that intergenerational connection can be discovered. And this brings us to the final, famous scene at the end of the film, Field of Dreams. Let's watch it.
You catch a good game.
Thank you. It's so beautiful here.
For me,
well, for me, it's like a dream come true. Can I ask you something? Is this heaven?
It's Iowa.
Iowa? Dreams come true. I'd like that. Is this heaven?
No, Ray says, it's Iowa. One need not be in heaven to hear the voice within us, to reconnect with the faith of our fathers, to take the ball from the previous generation, to allow the sound of Sinai to resound through us. One need not stand on Sinai, but one does have to listen for the voice within. As I prepared for this talk and I watched that final famous catch scene, I was struck by the many comments that people left on YouTube about it. Here are a few. Someone wrote, "Took a girl I really liked to see this film, first date, blubbered uncontrollably, along with pretty much every guy in the theater during this scene. She was not impressed. Guess I was too wimpy for her. That was the end of that potential relationship. After that, knowing I would choke up, I rented the DVD and watched it with a new girlfriend. She cried too. Married her." That's one quote. Another, "The first time I saw the movie, I thought it was the dumbest movie I ever watched. I was playing baseball in college, a pitcher nonetheless. I was playing catch with my dad all the time. The second time I watched it, my dad had long passed. I cried like a baby. I have to get to that field one day." And then a third comment, which read about the catch scene, "This scene should be on the legal citizenship test for the United States. If they cry, let them in. We'd be honored to have them." And finally, someone wrote, "I was working in a movie theater when this came out. Back in the days of 35 millimeter prints, we manually put light cues on the beginning and ends of movies. Usually, we just look at where the credits started and put the lights up cue a few frames later. After the opening weekend, our manager told us we had to take the lights up cue off entirely because too many people, mostly men, were still sitting in their seats crying, and he didn't want them to feel like we were rushing them out the door. This is a special, special movie." It is indeed. The need for connection is so profound. And if we can feel emotional over a beautiful bond around baseball, then how much more meaningful is the bond of generations formed by God, one that began with Abraham, was celebrated at Sinai, and which lasts for all eternity. We need not stand at Sinai or Mount Carmel to allow the Almighty's voice to enter our lives and to hear the voice inside us that seeks this sanctity. All we need to do is to listen and to build lives worthy of what this voice tells us about God. If you build it, he will come. Thank you very much.